I have that name for you. Now, here we are. This is, if you want the citation, it's in Antiquities chapter 8. He says this. Now, this is Agrippa the First. You got this? Agrippa the First, who beheaded James, and whose death is told about in Acts 12. Right?
Right.
Okay. He says this. Now, when Agrippa had reigned 3 years over all Judea, see, it was restored to him by who? Caligula. Restored to the Rhodian family, given to him. He came to the city, Caesarea, and there he exhibited shows in the honor of Caesar. And Luke tells in Acts 12 about going to Caesarea and putting on these shows. On the second day of which shows, he put on the garment made holy of silver. And he's covered this one, he took state acts, I don't want to. He put this garment made holy of silver and of a contexture truly wonderful. And as he made this garment, so it would reflect light. And what he did was, he came to the theater early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it, shone out after a surprising manner. What he did was, he was up on a show. So he gets this garment that reflects light, and he gets on the edge of the top of this, the amphitheater of Caesarea, and he stands so that when the sun comes up over the Judean mountains to the east, here, at the east, it would shine directly upon this garment and reflect light. People would be dazzled by it. What does Luke said? They said the voice of God, not of the man. It's exactly the effect he wanted to produce. It was quite a show. Anyway, it spread, and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those that looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out from one place, another from another, and then Josephus adds, though not for his good, as we're going to see later, that he was a god. See, Luke records it, he was a god. And they added, be thou merciful to us, for although we have hitherto reverenced thee as only as a man, shall we henceforth own thee as a superior to mortal nature. Now I'm going to look to you as a god. Upon this the king did neither rebuke them nor reject their impious flattery. But as he presently afterwards looked up, he saw an owl. This was supposed to be an omen of his death. His birth. A severe pain arose in his belly. He began in the most violent manner. And all of a sudden, and Herod knows, something held him. This is it. He therefore looked upon his friends and said, I, whom you call a god, and commanded presently to depart this life. He said, I think I bought it. While providence thus reproves the lying words you just now said to me, and I, who was by you called immortal, am immediately to be hurried away by death. You call me a god, now you're going to find how ungodlike I am about that. He probably didn't say this. Josephus probably made the speech up for him. Because, to show that he learned his lesson too late, and he wasn't a god. Now, maybe he actually said it, but it's not like Herod's saying this. So, that's one of the problems with Josephus' speech. And we thought a man should have made a speech, we should have given him one. When he said this, his pain was become violent. Accordingly, he was carried to the palace, and the rumor went abroad everywhere that he was certainly dying in little time. But the multitude presently set in sackcloth with their wives and children, the law of their country, and besought God for the king's recovery. The most insincere praying of all time. Lord, please help him get well. If you really want to. Anyway. All places were also full of mourning and lamentation. This is official mourning. Now the king rested in the high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. Here's all these professional mourners down there weeping. He got in the spirit of the thing. He started crying too. Maybe I wasn't such a bad guy. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed his life, being the 54th year of his age and the 7th year of his reign. Now this, you got this? I meant to go, this is the Herod, who was the one, Agrippa the First, who beheaded James. Agrippa the Second, his son, formed Paul of here, but preached the gospel. Okay, you got that? Herod the Great, birth of Jesus. Herod Antipas, governor of Galilee, king of Galilee, for whom Jesus was tried. Agrippa the First, beheaded James. Death is told in Acts 12. Agrippa the Second, for whom Paul appears. Now you can't, we go through this because if you just read the scriptures, you don't know this. You can't tell. You have to get this outside information. Yes?
Josephus doesn't say that he was eaten by worms, doesn't he?
No, he said his pain in his belly.
Yeah.
Herod the Great, the lot where I didn't make, well, I had marked, I mean, I stuck the paper in, I don't have time to read it. Herod the Great, when he died, he realized everybody hated him, nobody was going to love him. So what he did, he had the leaders of Jerusalem, the leaders of Judea, the natural Jewish leaders, brought into the amphitheater, locked in, and the archers sent in, and he sent with the order given, that when you give it, I'm dead, you kill all these men, by 700, so that there'll be mourning in Jerusalem. He knew, you know, the little story up there, we can't have, Amos and Andy's on the radio, I said, ask Kingfish one time, I said, Kingfish, you got life insurance? He said, no, sir. He's going to have no life insurance, because when he died, he was going to sing in the street. And Herod knew that as soon as he died, you know, it was going to be the most very insincere mourning, because when he's singing in the streets, so he just couldn't tolerate the idea of the Jews celebrating when he died, so he ordered the leaders of the nation slaughtered at his death so that he'd be sure to be mourning. Yeah, great weeping in the city when he died. He didn't care for him or not, just wanted nobody was laughing. You can see why the scriptures say when Herod trembled, all Jerusalem trembled with him. I mean, a fellow do that, kill his own son, kill his own wife, you know, pull a trick like that. I mean, when he got upset, he told nobody's liable to be. So when they heard that Herod was upset, the whole city came along. Okay? Well, much more to be, yes. Well, because there were those who were lost, and you see, his successor was coming out. He had to live with his son, Archelaus. Well, there's much more to be said. I just hit the high points, but I don't have time to develop all the story of Herod. It's very complicated. But I simply want you to be able to identify the Herod that you read in the New Testament. And to understand why that there is a Herod who is king of Jerusalem when Jesus is born. There is a Herod who is king of Jerusalem when James is beheaded. Book of Acts, early book of Acts. But there's no Herod who is king of Jerusalem in Jerusalem at the trial of Jesus. But during that brief period, Judea came under the governor because of the misrule of Archelaus. Later on, we'll restore it. Okay? Yeah.
What did you say Herod
is? I don't know.
I just have a
name. Sorry. I don't know. Did you mean that?
These were puppet kings. They were. Agrippa? Well,
seems like he was.
No, well, see, he didn't have jurisdiction. He was. Now, really, you had just Herod and Agrippa II. Now, the story behind that. See, he appears. Agrippa the first received the rule. Again, this was constantly being changed. See, Rome was overseeing. Rome was in charge. And actually, I think Gwen did, but since you raised it, let me say this a minute ago. Agrippa the second, for whom Paul stood, he was a king without portfolio. He wore the title king. He was allowed by the Romans to be king. But actually, the Romans had, for all practical purposes, given the rule back to the governor. He was allowed to wear the title, but more, and he had some honors and responsibilities. But really, for this Agrippa, it was an honorary title for the most part. It's kind of like, at this point, he's like the king of England. He's not in charge of the middle. The king reigns, but he does not rule. And by Agrippa II, he reigned, but did not rule. It was more than anything else an honorary title. Because of our time limitation, I did just want you to be able to identify the Herod that you read about in the New Testament. Okay? I'm going to skip Judea under Roman governors and says, but I don't want to talk about it. And, no, we covered kind of being pressed by time, and I really don't think it's all that important. And I covered what I consider the salient points in our discussion of the Herod. And also you have some information on the government and the Carlisle outline I gave you. Go ahead, quiz. Monday.
Let's have a Tuesday, please.
How many want to have a Tuesday instead of Monday?
Wednesday.
I want to have a Monday.
Oh,
Monday, when?
Yeah,
25 votes, right? Oh, I don't care. Tuesday's okay. It will be over. A quiz now. Over the Caesars, the Herodian succession, and what we're going to cover today. Okay? We're over the Caesars, the Roman emperors, over the Herodian succession, as discussed yesterday, and what we're cover today. Today we're going to finish this section today. Look down at Roman numeral 7, the Messianic Hope. Now, this is in my opinion, a very important subject. By the way, I think your textbook has a whole chapter on it, Bruce. And we begin by pointing out that the Old Testament predicted that the Messiah was going to come. In the age of the... the age of the prophets brought more specific predictions about this Messiah. In the age of the prophets, there emerged two vivid particulars concerning the Messiah when he should come. In the book of Daniel, we have the concept that the Messiah, when he's going to come, he is going to be like David. Although this language is used in the Psalms, and this prophecy is certainly in the older sections of the Old Testament, but specifically, Daniel prophesied that in the days of the fourth empire, that is, in the days of the Roman Empire, the Messianic kingdom would be set up, and it would stand in contrast to the worldly kingdoms such as Babylon, Persian, Greece, and Rome. Because this kingdom would be divine in origin. It would be, for instance, the great image of the great vision of the image, a stone cut out of the mountain, not with hands, comes down, the crest of the image. It would be divine in origin, and it would never end. The Messianic kingdom. The Jews thought much about this. And the last question, the disciples ever asked Jesus on earth was, "Will thou at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Okay? Also in the age of the prophets, there emerges this concept that this Messiah will also be a redeemer. Isaiah 53. By his stripes we are healed. He was wounded for our transgression. He was bruised for our iniquity. The chastisement of our peace, that is, peace with God, was upon him. And by his stripes we are healed. Now, so he's going to function in a priestly way. He's going to function in a royal way. Redemption and rule, you want to divide it that way. Y'all see that? So you have a two-pronged emphasis. You have the concept, the Messianic concept, coming to focus on two points. He is going to redeem, as Isaiah said. He is going to rule. Now, I just use Isaiah and Daniel as examples. That's certainly not exclusive to these prophets. I mean, ideas were early. They are just made more explicit by the prophets. Now, the Jews had a tough time understanding how a Messiah could both redeem, could come and die. He has led like a sheep to the slaughter. They worry about this. They struggle with this. When our Messiah comes, if he's going to come to set up a Jewish world empire, if he's going to restore the glory of David's kingdom, is going to come and once again make of Israel a glorious nation and rule over them. How can he do that and die? It seemed to be antithetical ideas. Interesting, what text was the Ethiopian eunuch struggling with as he was going back home? Isaiah 53. Of whom did he speak? Of himself or some other man? This text received much attention. Now, you remember in our discussion of the Dead Sea Scroll, this is a reflection of a cult or a sect of Judaism in the intertestamental period. You recall our discussion of the fact that they had worked out a way to solve this dilemma, how he could come and rule at the same time he comes and dies. And what was it?
Huh?
Right. Remember the Dead Sea story here, the concept that really the Old Testament did not prophesy one Messiah. It prophesied two Messiahs. One would be the priestly Messiah. One would be the Davidic or the royal Messiah. One would come and die, and then following one would come to reign. Now it's interesting that there is in the Talmud, and with the Talmud it's difficult always to see how old these ideas were and are, but the Talmud, even though it's in its edited, written form, is certainly post-Christian, about 8500, yet it reflects many ideas that are pre-Christian, and so it's difficult to say, but the fact remains that in the Talmud, regardless of how old this idea is, in the Talmud you also find the concept of two Messiahs. Did you know that? The Talmud, now this may be post-Christian. That is, it may be because the Christians pose such a challenge they come to this theory. Or it may be pre-Christian, and the fact that we find this same idea in the Qumran documents indicates that it could be pre-Christian. So, regardless of where we go down in time for all of Judaism, we are on safe ground in affirming, recognizing the fact that the Jews, that one of the ways that they saw this dilemma was, they came up with the concept of two Messiahs. Now, how many Jews held that idea and when is very problematic. But it's interesting that this illustrates for us, makes vivid this problem that they have. But understanding what the Old Testament said. Secondly, with this, though, first of all, they solved the dilemma in their own minds. Some of the Jews did at various times by saying, well, there were two Messiahs. Found it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, found it in the Talmud. We know the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, are pre-Christian. The Talmudic idea is less certain. Yeah.
What gave me the idea that it wasn't trying to be a spiritual thing? In other words, why did they?
Because the language of the Old Testament, if you take it literally, physically, you would conclude that when the Messiah came, he was going to set up a Jewish world empire. He would rule over Israel, Israel would rule the world, or Israel would. So this would be the eternal Messianic kingdom.
Wasn't there any way that they would have known it was meant spiritual?
Yes, but there are many signs in the Old Testament, hints, that it was not to be a physical kingdom at all. Like the temple of the Messianic kingdom. Ezekiel's temple, obviously not a physical temple. The old thing of it's hyperbolic language, exaggerated dimensions to indicate the extreme glory of it. But no one believed that it was probably the whole dimension, it was out of proportion. Way too big, and Gentiles would just serve as priests in the temple. You see, obviously, it was not simply one more Jewish temple. So there were signals which they many often ignore. It's like, that's what you have in Revelation. It's silly to think that the holy city in Revelation is literally a literal city. It's not. But it's a cube. And the first thing to know by reading that is it's way out of proportion, that it's figurative. It's a figurative description of the glorious of the church. Glorifying. Yeah, it's high, it's wide. Well, that's not beautiful. Common.
Cube.
Well, anyway, so the verse signals that they ignore them.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be hard to look at a spiritual thing, especially with the situation they're in?
Yes, very good point. You know what he's saying? Well, I'll put it in my own words. What John is suggesting is that they I'm sorry. They were an oppressed people. First oppressed by the Babylonians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, and the Greeks, and the Romans. And they would naturally long for their turn to be in charge. Their Messiah, there were the Jews who would tend to say this, okay, you can pomp on us now, but you wait till our Messiah gets here. You're going to get yours. Then we're going to see who runs the prison and who's in it. Then we're going to see who's the master and who's the slave. What they tended to do, this brought me up to my second point, they tended to deal with or respond to this dual concept of the Messiah by either two Messiahs, or they tended to ignore the priestly element for the reason that you gave them. They tended to ignore this and emphasize this. When he comes, he's going to rule. Here's what it's very common. You talk about a Jewish belief. This, in the first century, there was no such thing as Judaism. There were Judaisms. Expressions of Judaism. The second, there was no such thing as a Jewish concept. There were concepts held by various Jews. But a common Jewish concept was that every Jew who was born, Abraham, that is, would automatically be a part of the Messianic kingdom. Being born of Abraham made you a part of the kingdom. And of course, I talked to you about the fact this is the background of the discussion of Jesus with Nicodemus, of course. Did I talk about that again? So Nicodemus says, we know you're a teacher come from God, no one can do these things but God be with him. But you see, Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. He wasn't acting the way a Messiah is supposed to act. What Nicodemus was really asking is, since you're the Messiah, where's your kingdom? Where's the kingdom? So Jesus begins to instruct him on what the kingdom is really like. He says, you've been born of Abraham, that's fine. That doesn't fit anywhere. You've got to be born again to get in my kingdom. That was the born of flesh is flesh. But you'll be born of the Spirit, you see. Well, anyway, and often, you see, when one of the emotional forces undergirding the Maccabean revolt was Messianic hope. The idea that the Jews were going to be led to establish a Jewish world empire, where Israel would be preferred. Now, that didn't work out. The Zealot movement, when they saw Jesus performing the miracles, they realized that, anybody can feed a crowd of, which numbers 5,000 men, besides women and children, with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Think about it. Wouldn't he be a great quartermaster for an army? When they saw him raise Lazarus from the dead, they said, wow, anybody can take dead men and make them alive? So no trouble taking the live men and making them dead. He's very good. And they kept trying to make him this. They kept trying to get him to go to Jerusalem instead of this temporal world empire. You see, that's the background. You understand for instance, triumphal entry. The crowd had rejected Jesus for a whole year, mainly because he wouldn't come near Jerusalem. And the temple leaders had said, he comes when he comes. So when they finally the word spread that he's coming to Jerusalem, here's what they were saying. Well, this is it. He's either going to set up this empire, or he's going to be dead. But since he's coming, what they shout, Hosanna to the son of David. Now he's going to come to Jerusalem and set up this throne, destroy the Romans. That's why when he didn't do that, he rode in on a donkey and they'd be all ready for him. When he refused to do that, the same voices were crying a day and a half later, crucify him. And Judas betrayed him and said, forget it. Now, this is so much in the background of the New Testament. This is very much a part of the world of the New Testament. And that's what this class, of course, is about. They, when, that's why, for instance, when Jesus said, you turn the other cheek, they said, wait a minute. It's not our Messiah talking. When our Messiah comes, it'll be somebody else's turn to turn the other cheek. Without having to go to it today, I didn't cut into your schedule. I have a class. Now, basically, this is the idea that crucified Jesus as far as the Jews were concerned. They said, well, what was the charge they brought against him? Blasphemy. I mean, the Romans, what did they put over his...
King of the Jews.
King of the Jews. Now, later on, and this idea, by the way, led to the destruction of the Jewish state. Remember Jesus said in Matthew 24, many false Christs are going to arise. Do not go after them. They're going to say, go here, go there. He said, don't do it. Don't go after them. Why? Well, that's not me. Now, that these false Christs did arise, and they presented themselves as the Messiah, and said, and they did exactly, or claimed that, said that they were going to do exactly what the zealots tried to get Jesus to do, and that is to lead in a revolt against Rome. As soon as they believed that God would miraculously intervene, and they would establish their empire. Now, so Jesus warns about this. For instance, we read in Josephus, when he's talking about the fall of Jerusalem, and he said this, and the events leading, he saw the events leading up to it, he said this, as the city is is being destroyed, a false prophet was the occasion of these people's destruction. Who had made a public, it is this prophet, had made a public proclamation of the city that very day that God commanded them is to get up on the temple and that there they should receive miraculous signs of their deliverance. Now, there was then a great number of false prophets suborned by the tyrants to impose upon the people to denounce this to them. They should wait for deliverance from God. And this was in order to keep them from deserting, that they might be buoyed up in love, fear, and care by such hopes. That is, the false prophets were bribed to keep the people from leaving, fleeing, and staying there expecting miraculous deliverance. So they thought this was the messianic hope. Thus were the miserable people persuaded by these deceivers, and such as belied God himself. While they did not attend or give credit to the signs that were so evident, and did so plainly foretell their future desolation, but like men infatuated without either eyes to see or minds to consider. But anyway, the point is that there was a widespread idea all through this period that now God is going to establish, give the kingdom back to Israel. Tacitus, for instance, records knowledge of this idea. Very interesting. He says this. Talk about the Jews now. Now this is a pagan Roman historian, late first century Roman historian. Prodigies, that is unusual events, that had occurred with this nation, that is the Jews, prone to superstition, but hating all religious rites, did not deem it lawful to expiate by offering a sacrifice. There had been seen hosts joining battle in the sky, the fiery game of arms, the temple illuminated by sudden radiance from the clouds, different stories that were going around this period. All the doors of the inner shrine were suddenly thrown open, and a voice of more than mortal tone was heard to cry that the gods were departing. The same instant there was a mighty stir as of departure. Some people put a fearful meaning on these events. But in most, there was a firm persuasion that in the ancient records of the priests was contained a prediction, the ancient records of their priests, that the Old Testament. The ancient records of their priests was contained a prediction of how at this very time the East was to grow powerful and rulers coming from Judea were to acquire universal empire. Tacitus, the reference is Histories, Book 5, 13. Histories 5, 13. interesting. So Tacitus, this idea was so popular with the Jews that the non-Jews knew about it. Suetonius, also, and what this reference is under Vespasian 4-5. Now Vespasian was the emperor who was ruling when Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. He said this. Y'all got that? Vespasian was the ruler. He followed Nero. Well, he didn't. There were three: Otho, Gabellius, and Otho Galban and Vitellius were three minor kings that ruled in between Nero and Vespasian. But they just ruled for a few weeks. They did not really hold it. They didn't reign. In AD 70, Vespasian was the emperor. He says this: an ancient superstition was current in the East that out of Judea would come the rulers of the world. This prediction is later proved. He said, referred to two Roman emperors, Vespasian and his son Titus. Titus was the general who destroyed the city of Jerusalem. But anyway, the point is that both Tacitus and Suetonius, and Josephus, all three, reflect this ancient Jewish conviction that when the Messiah came, that the Jews were going to rule the world. You can see why they would have such a hard time accepting a humble Redeemer who would die for them. Can't you? I mean, their Messiah was going to come and overthrow Rome, mighty Rome, he was certainly going to have to be tougher than Rome. The one thing he could not do was come and be humble and die. In other words, they said, when our Messiah comes, he's going to kill the Romans. But what happened? The Romans killed him. One of the reasons why the Jews had rejected the gospel, this idea was firmly planted in their minds, through a selective reading of the Old Testament, through a misreading of the Old Testament, mainly through prejudice and desire for glory. And people like this. That's why, for instance, when Jesus came preaching meekness and humility, even John the Baptist, when he was in prison, sent his messengers, some of his friends, disciples, to say what to Jesus. Are you the one that should be looking at heaven? You understand? The basic proposition in all this is what Jesus told Pilate. Pilate asked him about this. Said, "You're a king." What did Jesus say? My kingdom is not of this world. It's interesting. You go through the book of Acts. I wish we had time to do this. If you go through the book of Acts, you find preaching in the book of Acts, preaching the church now, the kingdom of God, focuses not upon the redeemer, but upon the rule, on the Davidic rule. Peter, who does Peter preach about first? David.
Thomas said, "Didn't Christ destroy his own life, go to the church, say,
yes.
You look at that.
This is the book of Revelation, it sounds exactly like that, by the way. They went about, look at this, note the language that Luke uses. They went about preaching the kingdom of God. All the prophets were about these days, the kingdom, preaching the church. And Paul writes, thanks be to God who has transcended us from the kingdom of darkness into what? The kingdom of his dear Son. Now, note this, we understand this idea was the solution to the idea was not to ignore, was not to posit two messiahs, as many did. I don't know how many, I've said. You got that? Either two messiahs, or simply ignore the priestly redeemer messiah, and remember and focus and enlarge upon the Davidic rule. The solution is in the gospel. That he died for us and he became the ruler of a spiritual kingdom, the church. And notice, the New Testament calls calls the church Israel. It calls Christians the temple. Now we understand, don't we, how Ezekiel, for instance, could say that in this new temple, Gentiles would offer sacrifices. Because we are Gentiles, most of us. That's all we do. We offer sacrifices, don't we? And that Paul could write to the Galatians, calling the church the Israel of God, the true Israel. And Paul could explain in Romans that Israel is not the Israel of the flesh, but Israel of faith. And always has been, by the way, there. Now we understand this, that in the days of the fourth empire, the days of the Roman Empire, as Daniel predicted, that the kingdom was set up, called the church, kingdom of God. New Testament is very clear about this. Jesus is very clear about it. But old ideas die hard. And so the Jews continue with the concept that, well, there's going to be two messiahs, that they find in the Talmud. But I maintain that if you don't understand what the Jews were struggling with, you don't understand much of Jesus' ministry. There'd be big gaps in our understanding. This is the idea, as far as the Jews were concerned, that eventually put Jesus on the cross. You see? They said, like Nicodemus, we know you're from God, but you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're the Messiah. They kept trying to get him to establish this Jewish world empire.
Yes. This book behind Jesus' statement when he talks about telling them to believe, this kind of whole thing, in order to get this barrier that they put up?
Yes. Then they came to Jerusalem one time. Because they were coming to Jerusalem, Jesus told them this parable about a man who received the kingdom and went to a far country to receive it, ruled in absentia. And he was personally absent, ruled through his representatives. Time and time again, the kingdom of heaven is like. Why did he emphasize? The kingdom of heaven is like a man who goes out and throws a net in the sea. And the separation of the good from the bad. The kingdom of heaven is like, well, see, they believe that when Messiah came, that would destroy all evil, the universal peace, with the Jews as the preferred race and the master race. They're in charge. Universal peace. No more evil. So Jesus says, it's not that at all. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who goes out and sows seed in the field, and his enemy comes and sows tares. And what do they do? Let both grow together until the harvest. Both evil and good will coexist until the harvest. The kingdom parables are all, or almost all, in direct refutation of this notion. He pounds at it. The spiritual kingdom. God could have set up a rule by supernatural intimidation anytime he wanted to. But his is the rule of love. It's a very basic concept. To show you how hard the idea died, the night that Jesus was crucified, Peter still was carrying a sword. But just in case. And what did Jesus say to him? Peter cut off the ear of the high priest. I think it's ridiculous. Peter was not a sword, but a fisherman. He didn't know how to use it, so he used like a chopping axe, I think. Came straight across, then the guy's head, and the guy blew that thing, what did he do? And on his ear. He says, in fact, now Peter, if we're going to do business like that, I don't need one stiff arm fisherman defending me with one sword, doesn't know what he's doing. All I've got to do is say the word, and I'll have what? I have 10 legions of angels here to know what they're doing. I mean, if I'm going to do it that way, I don't need you. Well, you know, anyway, I'll get 10 legions of angels who are good at it. We'll do it right. That's kidding. I think it's hilarious. I think you just smile when you said that. You understand that, Ready to back door. But you see, it wasn't to be done that way. Need I say more about my point? We can just go through the gospel narrative and just see almost every page this concept Jesus is talking about. It. Now, the last thing I would say is about this idea. It's this idea. This problem the idea that Jesus is the really two messiahs, and this way of thinking that emphasizes the royal aspect and ignores this pretty much, is still a very popular idea. In fact, most evangelicals still hold it. It's like a version of it. You see, the New Testament preachers have been very plain that there's only one Messiah, and that in the church, his ministry as Redeemer and as ruler are combined with it. Jesus Christ, our Redeemer and our Lord, died for us and runs our life. He's combined. He's combined. However, this idea is a very durable idea. The Jews had the idea that crucified Jesus, as far as the Jews were concerned, as I said before. Now, there's a slight modification of it around today. It's not that Jesus was, but there's two messiahs, but there's two kingdoms. That Jesus came the first time and set up a kingdom, not really talked about in the Old Testament, which he ruled as Redeemer. But when he comes back, then he's going to set up the Messianic kingdom, the Davidic kingdom, rule from Jerusalem over Jewish world empire. A popular view. Mm-hmm. You look like that kind of earth, and read about it. Most all assemblies of God teach it. 99% of all the Baptist churches teach it, about a third of our churches teach it. And you think the very good book is on the subject, it's called the New Testament. so that the idea that the church was not mentioned. The most systematic explanation of this is in the footnotes of the Scofield Reference Bible. That the church is not really the kingdom. State kingdom in some sense, but it's not the Messianic kingdom. That when Jesus comes back, then he's going to establish the Messianic kingdom, Thomas and Daniel. Then he's going to go to Jerusalem. And he's going to conquer down all the enemies. World or universe is going to save all the Jews. And a universal world of peace. Well, this concession of the premillennialism is very popular view. And it's still the view that crucified Jesus, and it's still heresy and blasphemy and unbelief. It teaches that. And so, for instance, what they try to do is get all the props back on the stage to give Jesus another chance to do it right this time. You know, revive it. Daniel said the days of the fourth empire. Rome was the fourth empire, so you got to revive the Roman empire, get it back on the stage, rebuild the temple, and get the nation, get national Israel back on the scene, and reinstitute animal sacrifice and get everything going again like you had it before. And then Jesus is going to come and try it again. Now, most evangelicals hold it, by the way. If you get your radio preacher, the 9 out of 10 is over. They're talking, they're already doing it. And preachers like it, talk about why we get so this idea, you got that in the place where someone said there's two kingdoms. He came once, and now he's going to come back. Then when he comes back, then he'll set up the Messianic kingdom, reign and miracle from Jerusalem.
And Matthew, I guess it's 24 and 5, he talks about his return. He talks about the signs first. And then
no, the signs are not for it. The signs are for the destruction of Jerusalem. The signs in that point were not for the return.
But then he says you do the sign of the sun, that can rain the clouds.
That has to do with the early history of the church. We can analyze it carefully. This is the study of Gospels. See, also we say that Jesus, it's impossible for Jesus to give a sign for his return because he didn't know this. Understood what the Christians were saying. That's why, in my opinion, the book of Revelation was written in symbolic language.
this be one of the reasons that brought about such a total destruction of Jerusalem?
Possibly.
To make sure they won't come back?
Yeah, possibly.
They didn't do nothing. The Jews have been very plain. They said to everybody, when our Messiah comes, the Jews are going to rule the world. But you see, in other words, this concept of dividing into two, you have to. In other words, if you're not going to accept it, if you're not going to accept the idea, if you do not accept the idea that the church is the Messianic kingdom, only the Messianic kingdom of Daniel, don't accept that idea. Then you've got to divide it up some way. You either got to have two Messiahs, or two kingdoms, one prophesied and one not. And you've got to have two people. It's a very popular idea today that God does not have one people, He has two peoples. He's got the church and He's got the Jews. And the New Testament doesn't blow that idea into a cockhead, it doesn't talk about anything. God only has one people. There's no distinction. Either Jew and Greek, bond and free, broken down the middle of all partition, God has no respect for persons. You put it all in unbelief that He might have grace upon all the world. I mean, time and time again, that God only has one people, and one plan of salvation, one Messiah, one way, by grace through faith. No other way. But you understand what I'm saying? But this division, they divided up in two peoples, two kingdoms, and it's very, very deadly. By the way, this idea is the grandfather, the father, either the father, the grandfather, the great grandfather of most of the cults. So this idea was first preached broadly in America by a man called William Miller. And when his prediction didn't come true, one group of his followers became the Seventh Day Adventists. Another group of his followers became the Jehovah's Witnesses. And one group of the Adventists were the seedbed from which sprang Prince of the Armstrong Knights. And the Mormons also sprang from this kind of stuff. In fact, there are hundreds of preachers who will stand out and tell you, if you don't believe in this, that when Jesus comes back, then He's going to set up the kingdom. He is going to be the Bible. Scrofius had what's called a mystery parenthesis theory. It's a parenthesis. The main problem with the Jews, the church is a parenthesis stuff, it's a mystery. It was an unprophesied interruption. The church, the Scrofia Bible, which most of the Baptists think was directly inspired, you know, the King James Bible is a footnote. The King James is the only inspired English version, and the footnotes are almost inspired. He teaches that the church was an unprophesied, unpromised, unpredicted interruption in God's plan. So a mystery parenthesis is what he means by unpredicted mystery. Parenthesis, interruption, inside. You go out and preach to the internet, you get to people's homes, you're going to do business with this idea. Why don't you understand where it comes from? Historical background. It goes all the way to tell you. It's a very old idea. Why does it live on? Well, for the Jews, it was so durable because, you see, the Jews thought that, the Jews knew that they were the chosen people, didn't they? But they thought that they were chosen to rule. And they weren't. They were chosen to serve. And when Jesus presented them this opportunity, they weren't at least interested in that. Also more fun to rule than it is to serve, by the way. He who would be the greatest among you must be servant of all. And unless they even pass this switch on, he's paid enough to get the idea. Well, the Jews are born to rule. Yes, master race, certainly. Any questions? I don't know. I think I have so many things to say about it, but this is the only day I'm going to give to it. I'm going to talk about it today. Do you have any questions they're asking now? My question is, do you understand what I talked about today?
Mm-hmm.
It's
an important lecture in that, even though I just gave it the broadest outline. But I want us to see that this idea is very much a part of the New Testament world. In my opinion, it's impossible to understand the gospel narrative unless you understand this is what was going on. And that it was such a compound that's reflected in the three primary sources for our period, in Josephus, Tacitus, Suetonius. Such a wide idea. And the idea of two messiahs, both in the Talmud and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it's very persistent in a different, in a modified form. It dominates evangelical Christianity today. It dominates.
They hold this view that, and they're Jews today, they believe that Jesus is the Christ, and I heard one of them teaching that that they had the Messiah, Joseph ben David, and you know this back and forth work. They had the idea that the concept of the two messiahs.
Yes. There's many, and your point is well taken, there are many versions of this. Yeah. Two messiahs, two kingdoms. They separate the priestly function. Here's what you get the first time that these teachers. Jesus came first time to be our Redeemer. When he comes back, he's going to be our Lord. The Bible doesn't say that. He comes back, he's going to be our judge.
Causing so much division in the Christian churches, because you're going to find that there's so many people that believe everything up to the point, and then when you come to the second coming of Christ, they think he's actually coming to live.
Yeah, God is. You should be getting a copy of the the reading assignment. When you get this, you get a reading assignment of Christ around Newsweek. There's a file folder in the reserve shelf. It's got three copies. Yeah, so you have this week to read it. Like you would this week. And there's three sets of help paper on the read it. Said short and the three copies on the class three size you have in the scope. And you're having access to read it. Okay? I was going to talk today. I want you to call martyr. Suffering for the cause. Every time you took a drink, his speech became more slurred. We'll give you back the test. We're going to talk about Jesus in Palestine, and this material we're going to talk about first, the discovery of ancient Palestine, from your outline. This as well been included in the last section on Palestine. Perhaps next time I teach, I probably will. So it doesn't make any difference. I don't want to hit it anyway. I'll get my final teach it a few more times. We'll talk a bit about the discovery of ancient Palestine, a lesson perhaps in archaeology. I think it's very important, especially to a history course. Archaeology is a handmaiden of history. It's the job of the archaeologist to produce data in a systematic way. It's the job of the historian to interpret that data and to correlate it with the other data to put together a comprehensive picture of the history of the period. So the relationship to a historian and archaeologist is this: the archaeologist produces the raw material and the historian correlates this raw material to the reconstructed picture of a period. And so it's important that we talk about archaeology. Archaeology is a really new science. I've made it say before, I'm very much interested in it. In fact, if I didn't think the preaching of the gospel was more important, I would be an archaeologist. Fascinating field, which is opening up. Palestinian archaeology is a comparatively new thing. New things are happening all the time. But you see, Palestine was ruled for 1,000 years by the Muslims. Muslims had no interest in archaeology, traditional, or their system. They just had no interest in archaeology. There was no care given to preserve the holy sites except very few. Dome of the Rock, the Mosque of Omar sits on Dome of the Rock where Abraham theoretically offered Isaac, and Abraham is a great figure to the Muslims, and they preserved that. But as far as excavating and sites, they had little interest. During the Middle Ages, Jerusalem at one time was occupied by the Crusaders, and they occupied many communities briefly, say briefly, or less than a century. You still go today, you can find the remains. When you go to Palestine, you will see the remains of Byzantine churches, and you've got the influence of early Eastern Christianity, and you will find the remains of Crusader palaces. Castles, not palaces, Crusader castles. Some still standing, or remains thereof, still in pretty good shape. They just simply built medieval European castles in Palestine, and they took the Holy Land away from the Turks to preserve the holy places. However, their interest in archaeology was very limited. They were interested in identifying the holy places, but they had no basis of scholarship for doing so. They sort of accepted, when the Crusaders went there, they wanted to rescue the ancients had a superstitious, ignorant view of ancient relics. For instance, in the 14th, 13th, 14th, and early 15th centuries in Europe, there were circulating all kinds of relics. There was enough wood. Everybody had a piece of wood from the cross. I'm not suggesting you put them all together, they had enough to build the ark. You could get one of Mary's teeth. Feudal lord had enough hairs from Mary's head that he sold them or gave them as gifts. You could get the knucklebone of John the Baptist, just relics. Nothing about the intellectual level of their interest. And by the way, Roman Catholic Church still has it all over the world, especially in South and Central America, and in Europe, it's Portugal, Spain, Italy. You'll find hundreds of these relics, literally thousands, which of course are for the, which are 99.9% hokum. That is, they did. Nobody had a piece of the burning bush. And they did not have a feather which fell from the wing of the angel Gabriel when he announced to Mary that she was going to have a child, I mentioned before. And they didn't have any Mary's teeth. And the one relic which is possibly legitimate, possibly, I don't know the word possibly, is the shroud. I'm going to have you. If you're reading about that, if you read that, the current converse with Christ's shroud, it would be possible. But the cross from which Jesus was wrapped in his burial. Now, one of the most famous relics of the Middle Ages was the cup, the Holy Grail, the question of the, about the question of the Holy Grail, and everybody had been like the cup that Jesus used at the Last Supper. Everybody had it. claimed it. Probably nobody had it, but that was the level of historical thought in the Middle Ages. Therefore, when they got to Jerusalem, they wanted to locate the holy places. They wanted to locate the tomb of Jesus. They wanted to locate the place where he prayed, where he was placed on the cross, in this section where Jesus was crucified, and different sites. And what they did was they simply accepted the traditional stuff, the traditional locations assigned to these, some of which possibly were sound, most of which were not. But they wanted to locate someplace, one of the places where Jesus lived and walked, or the apostles were married, or they sort of, if there was a traditional view, they accepted it. There was no basis of examination. They did not examine it. There was no point of comparison. There was no scholarship to undergird the examination. They had no way of finding out for sure if this really was the spot if they wanted to. But they weren't that interested. And so, even though the church temporarily occupied that site, some of the sites in Palestine, not many of them, during the Middle Ages, there was no contribution whatever made to what we call a genuine knowledge, archaeological perception of Palestine. The interest renewed at the Renaissance, interest in scholarship, but the interest was in the form of 18th, 17th, 18th century travelers such as Pietro di Bella Valle, a famous character figure in the Old Testament, in the Renaissance period. He's the one who exposed the spurious donation of Constantine, where the Emperor Constantine was supposed to have given Western Europe to the Pope because he cured him. And that was the legal fiction that supported the church's claim on Western Europe. But anyway, Pietro del, but they would, there was a, they would simply travel, they were tourists. And up till the main interest in Palestine, it's more the topography of the places, up to the middle of the 19th century, was simply, many people would call it tourists. They go and they look and they would draw up sketches, or later on take photographs or daguerreotypes photographs, and they, but there was not much, it was not based on any better knowledge than the Crusaders had. There is very little. For instance, give me an example. If you go, when you go to, and we'll talk about this later, but when you go to Palestine today, everybody waxes the emotion about Gordon's Calvary. The one outside the city. You ever been there? You know, Gordon's Calvary. Oh, Gordon. Out there with the tourists. He looked at the hill and liked it and waved at it. And, but he was not a scholar, not an archaeologist, he was a tourist. Thought I'd be a good place for that to be identified or located, so he did so. Now, beginning in 1800, there began to be a greater interest in Palestine. One of the earliest, and I'm not taking any of this, J.L. Burkhardt, a famous scholar, he's a Renaissance scholar, he discovered ancient Petra, which is down here. This is that, this is about where the line is, was off the map. Petra, I think, when we go to, I think you've seen this thing, you probably go there, is that this fortress cut back in this natural canyon, a pink or rose colored rock, and it cut going down the side of the rock. He became a Muslim and was converted to the Muslim faith. And so much for Burkhardt, he located it, but that was about it. In 1838, there was a revolution in Palestinian studies. There were two scholars, an American theologian, Edward Robinson. You don't know about these men, Edward Robinson. And he traveled for 3 months in Palestine with a pupil named Eli Smith, Edward Robinson, Eli Smith. Now, these men were particularly well, Edward Robinson was an American theologian, but he had a German training. He had trained under Gazanius, the famous philologist, German philologist. Therefore, he had been trained in the German school of scholarship. Now, the Germans had pioneered in what we would call systematic or scientific historical studies. There's a German, for instance, the German von Ranke, for instance, who instituted the seminar system, where scholars get together and they divide up a period in which the historians are divided or subject in some way, depending on what's the historians or philosophers, whatever. And they each one will write a dissertation or a thesis or a paper on a certain period, and he will submit it to the others, they will read it, they will analyze it. And called a seminar, and this is, you know, where you get where the systematic scientific scholarship. I know that Dr. Cogan and I can go through. We had to have four seminars. That's where you either make your or break it. Well, you got to think of stuff writing papers. I was like, I'd write a paper that it had a semester to write it, and you had to submit a copy to the professor and a copy to the assigned critic, and the rest of them agreed it too. They go over everything, every period. Spelling of every word, the form of every footnote, your argument, your source, they would run down your sources. Is your source really say this? Is your conclusion sound based upon what this source says? All primary sources, and then they just, so you go in, when you're writing, I get to defend it to the whole class. I've been in seminars where students' paper just disintegrated. But it would not hold up. I've been in seminars where the students lose their cool and cuss out the professor. The whole semester's work is gone down the drain. They wrote a paper that would not hold up to scholarly criticism. And you don't fail the course, you get washed out of the school. You write very careful term papers. Well, this system was instituted by the Germans. Yes.
He said this was a systematic scientific what?
Scholarship. Or he would not simply go on, in other words, he would not simply go on traditions, if somebody, you know, or go on mythologies or whatever. He would sound scholarship. His student, Eli Smith, was particularly helpful because Smith was at home among the Arabs, who all controlled this land, of course, at this time, and he knew Arabic. He had served as a missionary for several years in Beirut, Lebanon, so he was at home in the countryside. And these two, what they did was they located many important sites in Palestine. Just simply located them. This is Bethel. This is Shechem. This is Samaria. It seems very basic to us, but at that time, that had not been done on the basis of good systematic method, and this was very revolutionary. 1850s, 1853, a scholar, De Salcy, the Frenchman, worked, and he was the first modern excavator of Palestine, where simply, see, before, there was no excavation as we know it. There was tomb looting, souvenir hunting, raiding, but no systematic excavation beside. Now, however, De Salcy didn't have enough knowledge, and there was no standard chronology, no way of dating anything. Even though he worked systematically, and the product of his work had little lasting value. In 1865, the PEF was established, the Palestinian Exploration Fund, PEF, is British. So the next few years, British dominated archaeology in Palestine. Palestine Exploration Fund. See, one of the problems you've got in excavation is it's extremely expensive. One of the reasons archaeology is an untapped field of study is because there are so few who know how to do it, and it costs so much money to do it. The Palestinian Exploration Fund, set up by the British, is a private foundation supported by philanthropic money from Britain. It, 1865, over the next several decades, it dominated Palestinian archaeology. One of the first ones was Charles Warren. Charles Warren dug systematically in Jerusalem. Charles Warren was his name. Now, however, again, there was no way, they had no way to date anything. They would find a piece of pottery, they didn't know where it came from. He misdated Herodian pottery. He viewed mounds as being purely natural formations. We know now that they were not, that the mounds were places where ancient communities or cities or villages existed. But he thought they were just hills. He found a piece of pottery, and he'd be very interesting, you know, he would describe it, because he knew it was. But he misdated it. There was no standard chronology. In 1872, two British scholars, Conder, C-O-N-D-E-R, and the famous Kitchener, did survey work. Mr. Kitchener, by the way, was you know the story of Chinese Gordon and his death at Khartoum? There was a movie made of it. Charlton Heston played Gordon when he defended Khartoum during the British period in Egypt. And it was Kitchener who came to his rescue too late. Somebody said Gladstone was injured because they needed a hero more than needed a victory. They let him die. Something. The Kitchener is one of what came too late. But he and Conder, they did survey work again, locating sites in western Palestine. This area right around in here. Yeah.
What year were they?
1872 through 1878. Again, in 1870, the AES, the American Exploration Society, was set up. American Exploration Society. But they didn't do a whole lot of good. There's some survey work done, but keep in mind, there were so few, that, in other words, you didn't have any good archaeologists because there were no such thing. Because we know archaeologists. These were scholars who would go out and do it. As far as the method was concerned, it was haphazard. Results were very poor, some inaccurate. The man who changed all this, in 1890, the missing genius was found. 1890, Sir Fender Petrie. We have Sir Flinders Petrie, a Britisher, of course. He had worked for, Flinders had worked for 10 years in Egypt. He was the first man, for instance, to measure the pyramids. He began to get the system, the science. He measured the pyramids. And he had found Jewish pottery in Egyptian tombs that were datable because of written material found in the tombs. Therefore, he began to categorize certain kinds of pottery with certain dates. That is, began to identify certain forms of pottery, certain designs on the pottery, the shape of the vessel, the shape of the handle, whether it was a geometric design, or there were animals or flowers or whatever it was. And he began to identify these with certain periods of history, certain eras. Well, he came to Tel El Kesti, site in Palestine, and this was really revolutionary. First of all, he established the fundamental principle of sequence dating. It seems very simple to us, but never occurred to them. The fundamental principle of sequence dating, that is, of establishing relative chronology. You simply could dig down at a site, and let me just dig straight down. Here's somebody concluded that this period represented the period of ours and a time of history later than this period. The farther down you went, the older it got. So that you may not know when it was, you knew that one was earlier or older than the other. Relative chronology. Not actually, there's absolute chronology where you can fix a date. But there's the relative chronology when you may not know when it was, but you do know it was before or after something else.
Did this go off the layers of the earth? Or
layers? Yeah, layers, right, of rubble. The layers of artifacts and coins. See, if they dig down, they find a coin. Well, they can date it absolutely, for the most part, now. Or find a piece of pottery, they can date it absolutely. But before, it's just relative. And he instituted, he got that, the principle, which seems very simple, of sequence dating. Second principle. First of all, sequence dating. Second one was ceramic chronology, which simply means, you see this over there? Ceramic chronology simply means dating by pottery. What he would do, simply compared to what he found in Egypt, he said, certain kind of pottery means a certain date. Now, he was fairly accurate, too. And the third thing that he instituted was this thing of keeping records. Instead of going and digging a site, about 1870, Heinrich Schliemann, the German, had excavated Troy. What he did was he simply moved tons of earth promiscuously looking for treasure. He found it, amazing. He found treasure, even dated it. But when Schliemann got through with the site, all he had was a hole in the ground. And there was no way of knowing, but there was no way, it was destroyed forever. He'd hire over 100 workmen, they just go in and just throw the dirt out, like looking for what the treasure, artifacts, man-made objects. Petrie instituted the system. As you dug down, as you removed layers, you simply made a record of what you found in each layer, so that later on you can make reference. But that's been refined a lot later. I'll talk about that later. But it's very simple. You can be doing. So we're going to dig this acre, and they wouldn't do that much, just 100 square yards or less. And they would just record what they found, and they dug it off, and then the next level, they would probably found and move the earth. So that later on, there would be some record of what was found where. For simple records, but again, the principle was there. Now, from 1890, for the next 2 years, under the TEF, Palestinian Exploration Fund, there was a lot of progress made in the refinement of methodology. Very few spectacular finds were made. Early in this period, amateurs made some brilliant amateurs would just happen on things. Really strange. One Frenchman named Charles Clermont Renaud, he found the famous Mieter Moabite stone, which is he sent to the Louvre in Paris, is still there. He also stumbled across this famous stone inscription, which forbade the Gentiles entering the temple. And some think that Paul had referenced this particular inscription when he wrote to the Galatians that the middle wall partition was neither Jew nor Greek, the middle wall partition had been broken down. There was a wall with an inscription on it, but no Gentiles could go down this point. And he found that inscription. Some other less brilliant finds. But even as amateurs, they just happened to stumble on them. Like a few years ago, some amateur stumbled on a bronze statue of Hadrian in Palestine. And the amateurs found a lot of things. But this, but that's not really not our concern. It's just about theology. Now, the they began, I'm going to men like R.S. McAllister and Bliss and Duncan McKenzie and others, don't worry about them, it's not, of course, not theology. But simply, what I want to state is that they began to dig in various places. The important progress was more in the area of refining technique or methodology than it was in what they actually found. The Germans got into the picture, and typical of German scholarship, they think nobody who wrote anything was German. They refused to learn anything from the British. What can an Englishman teach a German? Answer? Nothing. And so they ignored completely the advances that had been made by Petrie and Bliss and just some others who had worked with them. And so they set out to excavate, for instance, a man, a German called Sellen, and he worked with a man named Watzinger, who was a Austrian. They excavated Jericho. They found the wall of Jericho. They ignored, let's say, the British techniques. And they dated the wall that they found there, as they labeled it as the wall which fell under the Israelite siege, late bronze wall, under the Israelite siege under Jericho. They found the wall that came tumbling down. They published it widely. They don't think that. This is the wall they found was about 300 to 500 years too early to be Joshua's wall. Joshua's wall has never been found. And yet, interesting, this was back in 1900.